This is Future Heist, conversations with people making change. My name is Rena Leave Smith.
So welcome to this edition of Future Heist, which is a special for Women's History Month 2024. So, among the founders of International Women's Day, the original International Women's Day, were German socialists Louise Zeitz and Clara Zetkin. If Zeitz and Zetkin were alive today, what do you think they would have gone for? Would they have applied to Belief Singapore's Instagram giveaway for International Women's Day to win the Youth Creato Age Knockout Anti-Aging Face Creams? Would they have tried Scottish Widow's special International Women's Day Can We Guess Your Age online pension mirror? Or would they have bought the Ruth Bader Ginsburg sandals from Twoobs? Would they, I think this is the one, would they have got 20% off in a special International Women's Day offer from all procedures with Clinicton plastic surgeons, including thigh lift, foxy eyes, breast augmentation? Who knows? We're here to discuss International Women's Day. Now, you would think from all the marketing campaigns and press articles that use words like empowered and fierce that International Women's Day is the Christmas of girl boss feminism, a mantra that says women can have and do it all. But I think we need to reclaim the radical roots of International Women's Day and say that this is not just a cheap marketing date to sell more sandals, vibrators, backpacks for your guns, you name it. It's an opportunity to discuss how women's oppression cannot be separated from capitalism. Internet sources I have read trace the first International Women's Day as far back as a women's demonstration in 1857, but most sources seem to agree that International Women's Day began around 100 years ago in its current form. In 1910, at the Second International Conference of Working Women in Copenhagen, socialists Louise Zeitz and Clara Zetkin, both from Germany, argued for an international event titled Women's Day, under the slogan, "The vote for women will unite our strength in the struggle for socialism." The following year, what galvanised the event's continuation was a fire at the Triangle Shirtwaister factory in New York on the 25th of March 1911 that killed 146 young women, working class women, most of whom were immigrants. The book Women, Race and Class by Angela Davis is a brilliant way to learn about the fight for women's equality and the way it was often dominated and shaped by white wealthy women, while the real and successful struggles of black and working class women have been forgotten about or glossed over in history books. So just as today, you have girl boss feminism, which encourages more female CEOs, more women-led businesses. Around the time that International Women's Day was set up, 100 years ago, the most well-documented movement for feminism was by middle-class women in the fight for vote, universal suffrage, well, women's suffrage. And I say not universal suffrage because many bourgeois suffragists did not extend their sympathy often to black women, black people, or working class people. But just as International Women's Day was founded by working class women and socialists, International Women's Day today can be celebrated very much as a victory in that tradition of working class women, black women, immigrant women, that sees women's emancipation and class struggle as linked. So the fact that it's on the calendar today is an indication that those struggles can win. So what would Louise Zeitz and Clara Zetkin think of International Women's Day in 2024? I don't think they'd be at all surprised by the way in which International Women's Day has been co-opted by the establishment and how so many issues remain unsolved. And that's because capitalism has remained intact. In fact, if anything, capitalism has got stronger. For the international socialist organisations who pioneered International Women's Day, supporting the socialist conception, they defined as female suffrage, votes, but also labour legislation for working women, social assistance for mothers and children, equal treatment of single mothers, provision of nurseries and kindergartens, distribution of free school meals, and free educational facilities in schools, and international solidarity. Today, the gender pay gap remains at a stubborn high, with it's estimated around 54,000 women in the UK forced to leave work annually. 80% of those working in the low-paid care and leisure sector are women, and women are far more likely to have caring responsibilities in the home. Austerity means that benefits for working mothers are constantly being squeezed or removed entirely, and 4.2 million children in the UK are living in poverty. The list goes on. Around 40% of children living in single parent families are in poverty. UK nursery provision is among the most expensive in the world. School budgets, free school meals are constantly being squeezed and slashed. So we still absolutely need International Women's Day, and no amount of girl boss feminism is going to change that. International Women's Day 2024 was on Friday the 8th of March, and on Sunday the 10th of March, same weekend, was an older celebration of womanhood, Mothering Sunday, Mother's Day in the UK. And I think we can't really talk about the exploitation of women under capitalism without discussing motherhood. So where International Women's Day was founded by working class women, Mothering Sunday is a Victorian celebration of womanhood for some women that pushes a much more reactionary ideology. And actually, if memory serves me correctly, Mothering Sunday was established when an employer took pity on a servant of theirs who couldn't go and see their mother very often. So established this once a year day, one day per year, where it was decreed that all people should be able to visit their mother. And I think it's interesting to think about that as an origin story, because it essentially means that it's a story of the ruling class taking pity on working people and on high giving them, in all their generosity, this day, the single day annually to see their mother. Because of course the Victorian period was a time when a lot of working people were newly migrating from countrysides to towns, from the village community, to work in either big houses or big cities for the ruling class. So it really represents quite different ideology to International Women's Day. The way motherhood is represented, regulated, and functions in society is an engine of women's oppression. And even if you don't choose to become a mother yourself, and plenty of women don't, and they absolutely have every right to make a choice about that, as a woman, it's the standard set around motherhood which determines so much of gender oppression and also exploitation of the working class. So in his work, The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State, Friedrich Engels drew the link between the breakdown of collective social fabrics of the prehistoric past and exploitation under capitalism. Engels and other Marxist feminists since have argued that the pre-agricultural period of history, known as the hunter-gatherer period, humans lived in a kind of prehistoric communism. So Engels used the word primitive communism, which a lot of people have since taken issue with in terms of the language. And it's true that as a white man, for many, Engels can represent kind of a problematic voice when talking about gender oppression. But I think that that language kind of obscures actually the fact that what he was saying was and remains quite radical, and a lot of the things that he put forward, most of what he said around this question of the family and women's oppression, most of it does still stand the test of time. But it's worth mentioning that, I think. So anyway, so you have this kind of this primitive communism or prehistoric communism, where in the hunter-gatherer period, where the needs of the wider group were shared between many members of the tribe or clan or whatever you want to, however you want to describe the social groups that made up life in that time of history. It's an important time of history to think about. I've never really been interested in that period of history myself, outside this issue, in the sense that, like, not a lot of interesting stuff happened. But what piqued my interest when learning about it is that actually the hunter-gatherer period makes up 95% of human history. So from an evolutionary, social, biological point of view, in terms of who humans are, how we've developed, what our sort of natural inclinations or some of our, a lot of the way that we are, if that can be defined, I think we do have to take into consideration what did happen in that period. And it's a contested time in history as well, because a lot of right-wing historians would argue that it was some kind of 1950s gender norms whereby the men went and hunted and the women stayed at home. Actually, they found the remains of bodies which they can identify as female with kind of hunting slings buried with them. I don't think that there's any proof, hard proof, that suggests that women were excluded from certain things in that time in the way that right-wing historians argue. Anyway, so you've got that time in history, very important. Then what changed that time was the agricultural revolution, and humans' relationship with the land changed in that time. So rather than being nomadic and moving from place to place in order to find food, instead people start cultivating crops and staying in one place. It's a period, even the transition lasted for a few hundred years. They think there was communities probably did a mix of both. But anyway, around 10,000 years ago, you had this shift, and it meant that the relationship with the land changed, and it meant that in order to cultivate crops, by definition, people are staying in one place. And this meant guarding the land against rivals and farming the land to produce food. It starts new wars over territory because certain areas become more valuable and more attractive to live in. You can't just move if things aren't working out. And so as a consequence, the relationship, because of this changed relationship with the land and the way society's organized around the production of food, etc., so too do the relationship between genders and between people and between generations actually starts to change. So whereas before the agricultural revolution, women had a few children, parents had a few children, only as many as the wider tribe could help carry when they did need to move, suddenly it becomes the goal to have as many healthy children as possible, particularly male heirs, to help produce the food and also guard your food producing land from rivals. And so what happens around this time is that the hitherto collective act of bringing up children that's shared between many people is confined to the private sphere of the family. So whereas before all members of a group would, it's thought, lend a hand in terms of socializing, feeding and looking after children, after the end of the hunter-gatherer period, this role is increasingly confined to women's role within the family. And women thus start to become the baby-making machines that they are to become, really, under capitalism. And the evolution from hunter-gatherer to modern-day girl boss feminism took many millennia to form. But this is really a key moment in history in starting to make that transition. It's worth mentioning that Engels based a lot of his research on work that was being done in the 19th century with people who were not living in Europe, people who weren't living under capitalism. And so, for example, indigenous people in North America. The sheer variety in terms of the way societies are organised around the world was breathtaking and just showed how flexible it could be. People's ideas about gender, much more flexible. And it has to be said, of course, that, you know, the process of colonialization has been standardizing things among along capitalist lines. Obviously, there's a lot here that I'm talking about and I'm trying to summarize, but we're gonna jump now from the agricultural revolution to the industrial revolution, which was not the invention of capitalism. Capitalism had already been around for a few hundred years. But it's another key turning point in terms of capitalism as it is today. And around the time of the Industrial Revolution, there was a rolling back of rights for women, whose role was even more confined to the domestic. So for capitalists, they even further entrenched the ideal of women as this, they called it the angel of the hearth, this idea of, you know, the caring, nurturing figure at home. And it was defined as, men's sphere was defined as public and women's sphere was defined as private. Children, running the household, etc. Now this, it has to be said, when I talk about who's making these definitions, these were bourgeois capitalist ideals. The bourgeoisie are the class of industrialists who won power from the aristocracy through a series of revolutions in the 18th and 19th century. And the under capitalism, what you have is the industrialists claiming power. And it was along their lines that these ideals were formed. Now, of course, this meant that according to bourgeois capitalist values, working class women, who the bourgeois were quite happy to employ for 16 hours a day down the mines and in the factories, etc., it meant that working class women weren't really women because they didn't adhere to this angel of the home, angel of the hearth, at home, angelic mother who doesn't labour. So now working class women and black women and slaves, etc., they're defined as less than, as women, because of their relationship to labour and how they survive. So I was thinking about this way in which it's almost like the ghost of that Victorian womanhood still haunts a lot of kind of discourse around what it is to be a woman today, especially when it comes to motherhood. I think the kind of girl boss feminism feels like it's had this sort of, you know, when it comes to work, but when it comes to being a mother, then it's very, these kind of Victorian ideals of the angel of the house, the angel of the hearth, they're very much still there. And I was really thinking about it recently when my daughter came home from nursery with this poem titled Mummy, I Love You. And I wanted to talk about it because for me, I think it really captures how, you know, even in modern motherhood, you still have those ideals. I'm going to read it, and I should say as well, this isn't in any way a criticism of the staff who put this together. I think that the staff, particularly at my daughter's nursery, but in general, nursery staff work incredibly hard, are incredibly underpaid and underappreciated by society. The private nursery model, I don't think is working particularly well, certainly not in the UK. It's really expensive for parents. The staff are really underpaid. I think we need a different system. But I did want to talk about some of the words that are in this poem. So, Mummy, I love you. Mummy, I know you love me by the way you show care. You hug me and talk to me softly. When I need you, you're always there. Mummy, I love you always. From my heart, I want to say, I'm so glad you're my mummy. Happy Mother's Day. It is a really sweet poem. There's a very cute picture of my daughter. But yeah, as I say, without criticising the people who put it together, the choice of language within that poem, I think it says quite a lot about the standards to which we hold women. You hug me and talk to me softly. Of course, there's lots of moments which are very sweet between me and my daughter, and I would like to think that we have a nice connection in that way. But I don't always talk to her softly. Sometimes I lose my temper. Sometimes, I mean, they talk in gentle parenting and all this kind of stuff about how you need to kind of keep your feelings in control in order for the... Sometimes I'm not very good at that, and sometimes my feelings spill over and I lose control of how I'm feeling. So that made me feel quite guilty. The ideas around motherhood are still pinned quite a lot on this idea of the meek and mild, soft and gentle mother. And I think you compare that to the fun, you know, slightly more robust ideas around what it is to be a father. I think you can see there that there's different standards to which parents are being held to. Or you have what I would call the Beyoncification of motherhood, where you're supposed to be this caring mother, but also a leader and also a business mogul and sexy and inspiring and, you know, someone that girls and gays want to be friends with and somebody that men want to be with. And, you know, this kind of sisterhood, perfect woman, all things to all people. So that, I think, is the reality of being a mother today. So what of the material conditions for women in 2024? So again, let's think about the family. Families are more siloed than ever before. So whereas 50 years ago, you might have been able to rely on a neighbour to watch your kids while you pop down to the shops, or you might have been able to allow your children to go and play outside unsupervised for a couple of hours while you tidied the house, made dinner, did whatever you need to do. These things are increasingly rare. And most help available to parents has to be paid for. So again, if we compare that to the pre-agricultural revolution era, when you had many people lending a hand, now the tribe is concentrated on just two people, and for many that really means on the mother. And it's the same as care for the elderly. You know, my dad remembers growing up in the house with his grandmother. My dad was born in 1947, so that gives you an idea of the era. And that was much more common, you know, having intergenerational families living under the same roof. These days, you're encouraged to live out your days in the name of independence in your own home, and then pay an absolutely extortionate price to live in a private nursing home. This benefits capitalists. It allows capitalists to squeeze more money out of people. If you're dividing people up into lots of little households, that's lots of sets of rents or mortgages or whatever. That's many washing machines, internet services that can provide all the different products that you need to run a household. If you split people up into many, you know, it feels a little bit like that's a kind of a... It's definitely a situation that capitalists are benefiting from. The answer to the challenges of social care in today's economy are private nurseries, cleaning services, retirement homes, or for those who can't afford that, it often falls to the unpaid labour of mums, grandmas, aunts, etc. So, and increasingly, that's why you have that statistic of 54,000 women annually in the UK leaving work to manage it all, or take a pay cut or a career break, you know, to fit it all in, which in turn leads to the gender pay gap, which in turn leads to women suffering far more under austerity than men, etc., etc. Now, why am I banging on about motherhood? Not just because International Women's Day happened to fall on the same weekend as Mother's Day in the UK this year. The question of motherhood is so central to a Marxist understanding of gender. Because you might ask, surely it's regressive to go on and on about motherhood when so many women choose not to become mothers? Several reasons. First, it speaks volumes about how class society is organised. So as a Marxist, I believe that society is about the ruling class exploiting the working class. The social fabric of the family is a bedrock way in which capitalists exploit a resource, which is family love, family life, for free. So to put it crudely, a capitalist expects a worker, when they show up on their first day of work, the boss expects you to know how to walk, how to talk, how to use a toilet, how to use a knife and fork. Who taught you that? More often than not, it was women. For free. And it's just the same as when a capitalist looks at a forest growing in nature and sees an opportunity to fell the trees and make toilet paper to sell at a profit. So too does the capitalist rely on free labour of families, usually done by women, in order to continue to exploit all workers. The family becomes the factory to produce new workers, new consumers, and also to maintain the ones who already are working. So I was thinking this morning about the rise of the trad wife and these women who are claiming that they're being anti-capitalist by rejecting the need to go to work and staying at home instead and cooking and cleaning for their partner. I hate to break it to you, but you are still in capitalism and you are still very much doing work by cooking and cleaning. The difference is you're not being paid for it. And actually, not only that, your partner, your husband or boyfriend, whoever, is probably much more productive at work because he's not having to think about ironing his shirts or making his packed lunch or whatever. And therefore, your husband's boss is able to extract more profit from your husband. And the best thing about it for the boss, they're not paying a penny extra for it. So actually, you are still very much in capitalism. You're still working for a capitalist, just not in your own name. So listen, I absolutely support the right of anybody to do whatever they feel they want to do. And I totally support trad wives and stay at home girlfriends to do that if that's what makes them happy. But I think they need to be more honest and more informed about how they fit into the capitalist system than to say that they're rejecting capitalism. And it's in this way that the family becomes the factory to produce new workers and maintain the old ones, the existing ones, sorry. So the working class has gained some benefits from the state and from employers. So for example, maternity leave, child benefit, etc. They were fought for by the working class and won through union action, demonstrations, etc. But they're woefully inadequate in today's climate and ever more threatened by austerity. The second thing I would say, I've personally experienced very poor mental health around becoming a mum. And I see a big link between the organisation of family life and poor mental health for mothers. I think women, it's hard to say who suffers more with poor mental health, but it's certainly true that women suffer from poor mental health under today's system. It's estimated that around a third of mothers report postnatal depression. Now, when I heard that statistic of one third of mothers report postnatal depression, I think that's a conservative estimate. I think anecdotally, speaking to women, I don't know any mother who hasn't suffered with poor mental health. And I think that the statistics of one third of mothers, I think that's the ones who are admitting it. Because of course, there's a lot of shame and anxiety around admitting to having poor mental health, you know, a lot of taboo. I'm going to read out a quote from a book I bought recently. It was actually my own Mother's Day present to myself, and it's called Motherhood, edited by Anne Coxon, and it's published by the Tate, the art galleries. And in it, there's all kinds of artistic representations of motherhood, from the sort of traditional divine depictions of, you know, usually the mother of Christ, etc., etc., through to, I love this one, the woman washing the baby in the sink, looking like she's absolutely worn out with life. Let's see who that one's by. Jack Smith, Mother Bathing a Child, from 1953. Anyway, I haven't really read the full introduction. I've only read a couple of pages of it, but I already found a quote that I really loved, and it's a quote by art historian turned psychotherapist Rosalika Parker, who wrote about maternal ambivalence in her groundbreaking book Torn in Two, from 1995. In it, she noted that how a mother is feeling about mothering, how a mother feels about mothering, or the meanings it has for her, is heavily determined by cultural representations of motherhood. Becoming a mother inevitably entails encountering dissonances and disjunctions between the lived experience of mothering and the sometimes contradictory, yet usually prescriptive or normative, ideals that mediate mothering. So in other words, when you become a mother, you've got this idea of what motherhood's supposed to be in your head, usually through cultural representation. And there's this, and then when you actually experience it yourself, there's this contradiction between what it was supposed to be in your head and what other people sell it to you as, and what it really is like. And I think it's important to bring this up because it really is an example of another central tenet of Marx's thought, which is alienation. You know, Marx talked about alienation as being the feeling of being disjointed under capitalism. Workers are alienated from their work because they don't own their work, because you go to work and you produce it, but it's produced for your boss, for your company, for your employer, and somebody else makes a profit from it and benefits from it. You have this kind of disjointed alienation that you feel with that work. Whereas if you are people, you know, people have always worked throughout human history, but if you're a hunter-gatherer working in the landscape to gather together your food for yourself and also for your tribe or community, you feel invested in that because you're going to be a key beneficiary of that. It's not going to be taken away from you by somebody else. So that's a central kind of thought in Marx's thought, is alienation. But I think that alienation is quite a malleable concept, and it applies to a lot of things within capitalism. And under capitalism, we really are alienated from ourselves, from our own children, from each other. And this hyper-individualized existence, it means that we're even alienated from children. We're not really around children. Before I had my daughter, I didn't really see that many children, even though I know people with kids. I've got a niece and two nephews who I see a few times a year. I've got younger cousins, etc. So I didn't really think that I was that cut off, but, you know, unless it was the school holidays, so there was a lot of kids around, you know, near my office, most days I wouldn't really be in space with children. And if I was, it was unusual. And then suddenly I had my daughter, and all of a sudden, 25 hours a day, 8 days a week, I'm responsible for this child all of the time. And I think that in itself, that material change in my life produced a bit of a shock. And I think that was one of the reasons why my mental health suffered. It happened to be a fact that I had my daughter during the pandemic, so life was even more isolated and even more kind of siloed, but I think it would have probably happened anyway. And we're also expected to start conditioning children from day one according to capitalist values. I think sleep is a topic that you really see this around, but there are others. So with sleep, for much of history, no one has slept 8 hours a night in a consistent block every night. However, since the Industrial Revolution, sleep was concentrated into one block in order to facilitate work in the factory, work in the office. And we're talking only really in the last sort of 200 years. Before the Industrial Revolution, most people were employed in what's called cottage industries. So, you know, in that phase of capitalism, people could dictate, people were essentially working from home in today's language, and people could dictate their own schedules a lot more. You also had the fact that agricultural workers worked in seasons. So, you know, winter was a time when you actually didn't do that much work because there wasn't much to be done. Summer, you'd be really productive and you'd be out a lot more. But, you know, the office and the factory has kind of standardized time in a way that sometimes I think gets overlooked or forgotten. And so for much of human history, actually sleep, rather than being in one block, they think it was more like in two blocks. You'd have a sleep for a few hours in the first part of the night. People would wake up in the middle of the night. It was thought it was tied to the evolutions around keeping the fire going and keeping people safe. People would wake up, they'd maybe pray, they'd maybe talk, make love, whatever. And then you'd have another sleep of a few hours. But like I say, it was much less standardized. And yet only in the last 200 years, which when you think about how long humans have been alive for, it's not really that long. Suddenly, people are expected to sleep in 8 hour blocks. And so practically, as soon as you get home from hospital or wherever you've had your baby, as soon as you're left alone with the baby, babies are expected to sleep alone in a bed by themselves in an 8 hour block at night. And of course, that doesn't really happen. And it just leads to this absolute kind of like explosion of stress for parents because they think, what's wrong with the kid? What's wrong with me? Why are they not sleeping? And one of the most annoying questions I found as a new parent was like, oh, are they sleeping through the night yet? And, you know, once I started thinking about it and reading about the history of sleep, I started thinking, well, do you sleep through the night yet? You know, lots of people don't sleep in an eight, you know, it's such an ideal, it's such a myth. And actually, in most of the rest of the world, parents sleep in the same bed as their child. But if you mention this in the West, a lot of people can feel a bit like weird around it. Because as I say, I think people have become alienated from their own children. We expect them to behave and think and talk like mini adults when they're not. They're children. And in our kind of hyper-individualized existence, we end up blaming ourselves and we think we're crap parents when actually, and then we'll look to experts to sell us a solution. When really, I would argue that it's the setup of the family, it's the setup of society, the vanished tribe, the lack of the collective, which is against us from day one. One of the biggest and most successful International Women's Day demonstrations was in 1917 in Russia, and it kickstarted the entire Russian Revolution. And very soon after, one of the first things they established was practical steps for women's emancipation, so which included creches, collectivized housework, so, you know, cooking and cleaning, that kind of thing. It was no longer just the individual responsibility of one woman in the family. It was, there would be like collectivized services for the whole community. Abortion on demand, that was a very central demand. All kinds of collective services and provisions that lift the daily drudgery for women. So why else am I going on about motherhood in terms of capitalism? The third reason is because the family is the bedrock of traditional values that capitalists claim to sign up to. And you can actually see a lot of forms of women's oppression flowing from the idealised family and the way the family is idealised. And it affects a lot of different issues, whether it be the abortion rights that are being rolled back in the US at the moment, which basically crowbar women into motherhood against their will. France might recently have enshrined abortion into the constitution, but if they aren't providing the budget or the services to back it up for new parents, then what's the point? Ireland voted against making women equal in the eyes of the law. Why? Again, in Irish society, there's a very strong, it's religiously inspired, but capitalist-backed idea of what women's role is. You know, people often sort of look at Irish society and think that there's something, you know, backwards or regressive about Ireland. I think it is tied to the fact that when Ireland first went independent, in order to survive as an economy, there was a doubling down of capitalist values on the population. Religion was used as a cover for it. Religion was used as the rationale. But I don't think it would be completely honest to talk about religion in Irish society without mentioning capitalism. So we can also see about, we can also see how ideas of women in the family as mothers, etc., are valued as inferior to men because of this family ideal, and there to serve the interests of men as mothers and wives, etc., and are therefore judged to be meek and mild and passive, and how this impacts not just mothers, but how all women are expected to fulfill that image and serve men's interests. So, you know, you look at sexual assaults on women, whether it's the stranger in the dark alley, whether it's by their own partners, which actually the majority of sexual assaults happens between partners or ex-partners, or indeed whether those sexual assaults happen by actual police officers like Wayne Cousins, we can see this as an expression of male dominance over women in society. You can see ideals of womanhood in the vitriol of Andrew Tate and people like him, or again that rise of the trad wife on social media. You can see it in the way that women are sold 1,001 products to make themselves prettier, smaller, thinner, weaker, more pleasing to men. I don't know if anybody remembers the show on TV that was called Snog, Marry, Avoid, which gave women makeovers, and literally, like, these women's pictures, before and after pictures, would be shown to men, and then they would be shown the footage of the men looking at their images as justification to why they needed to, like, not wear that kind of makeup, but wear this kind of makeup. I mean, it was, I loved to hate that TV show. I watched it as kind of car crash TV because it was just so ridiculous, and it's like, it was so obscene in like how obvious the sexism was. And I also loved when the women, like the women who were like, nah, I'm still gonna like wear my fake tan, my fake nails. I loved it. Anyway, nowadays you get men ranting on TikTok about what doesn't turn them on. You can also see how ideals of womanhood in the family then play into questions of trans people and whether people can or should be able to change their gender and what that means. I think there's that all those gender expectations are tied up in that, and also in homophobia in terms of saying this is what a man should be, this is what a woman should be, you know, all those ideals. It's all about really saying that women and men should fulfill their function in society in terms of keeping capitalism going. That's really what it's about. It's about forcing people into those roles. The contradiction, of course, being that, you know, they keep telling us how natural being a woman is, being a man is, and yet, as Judith Butler wrote, they regularly punish those who fail to succeed in those roles. You know, if a woman's deemed to be too loud or too masculine, then just sort of, you know, ostracised by society or ridiculed by society. But if it was so natural, it's so contradictory. I mentioned Andrew Tate there, and I want to finish on the point of what distinguishes a Marxist feminist view of gender roles and more mainstream feminist ones. Feminism's a broad church, but actually the gender roles that flow from the family don't just affect women, they are also toxic for men, as in the phrase toxic masculinity. The expectation on men to provide, I spoke earlier on mental health. When I was originally writing this, I sort of wrote in the phrase the gender mental health gap, and I thought, oh yeah, women, they suffer a lot more from mental health. But actually, I thought, hang on, no, the rates of suicide among young men are far higher than for young women. I don't know many men at all who can openly and easily talk about their feelings in the way that women I know can. And often the ones that I do know who are open around it, they tend to be even more open to their female friends and partners than they are to their male friends. Of course, that's changing, and which is great. But it's worth saying that, you know, the traditional masculine ideal keeps men from accessing feelings in a way that I just think is quite tragic. Now, it's also come up for me among the discourses around the war in Palestine and the genocide that's happening there, because there's a lot of narratives, especially from the liberal media, talking about the tragedy of the death toll for women and children in Gaza, which is absolutely heartbreaking, awful, totally avoidable. It should be making us very angry. It should be making us want to take on the system. It should be making us want to challenge what's going on there with everything we've got. And it's absolutely true that too many women and children in Gaza are dying. But it's also true that too many men in Gaza are dying as well. I think holding up women and children as the only civilians worthy of our sympathy or outrage does a disservice to Palestinian men, actually. And it's not just true in Gaza, it's true across conflicts around the world. However, and this is the bit that distinguishes mainstream feminist interpretation to a Marxist feminist interpretation of feminism, we don't blame the men. We reject the idea of patriarchy theory. So I went to the Women in Revolt exhibition at the Tate, which is very good. If you are able to visit that exhibition in London, I would highly recommend it. It's a huge collection of all kinds of art done by women about womanhood and what it means to be a woman, between the years of 1970 to 1990. But there was a section on nuclear war. The campaign for nuclear disarmament was very big in that period, much bigger than it is today. It was much more of a concern at the time, although it's not a threat that's gone away. But there was art that sort of equated the threat of nuclear war with male violence, which got me thinking that actually I think that idea of men versus women is quite a misleading one. Because as frustrating as it is when your male partner doesn't pull his weight around the house or take a lead with childcare in the way that you would like him to, actually, the problem isn't just with that man, although it does feel like it at the time. And don't get me wrong, I whinge aplenty to my friends about that. Actually, the point is that the family and gender roles in capitalist society are organised along class lines. So it's like I said at the beginning, we believe as Marxists that it's life is about, history is about, the struggle between the ruling class and the working class. Working class women and men both are losing out to the ruling class. And as long as we fight each other, the ruling class will always win. And shrinking the tribe to two people means that instead of an organised collective, the ruling class have weakened the working class. By making all these daily struggles of feeding, clothing, bathing, cleaning the house, reproducing, by making all of this social care, the personal problems of families in general, and women in particular, capitalists are able to, first of all, sidestep their responsibility for any of that, and more profitably, exploit the working class. It has to be said, there was a campaign in the 1970s, which I believe started in Italy, for wages for housework. And it was this idea that the work that women do in the home whether they also have a paid job or not, but the work that women do in the home has economic value, because you cannot run a society unless children are fed and bathed and clothed and taught how to use the toilet. You know, and yet it's unpaid. And there was a movement for wages for housework. It sort of has it has its merits, because it enables people, I think, to talk about that issue and understand how these things fit into the capitalist economy. However, it's sort of a sticking plaster to just like pay you monetarily, because then does it justify and enable the continuation of that gender split, when really more there should be a more even balance? Or I would say, like, it's a nice, it might be a stopgap, but I think what we really need is a revolution, actually. What we really need is a total reorganization of society, not simply paying the wages. However, it was very interesting debate and campaign, and I think there's a lot of value in it. So it's not simply about paying your girlfriend to iron your shirts. And neither is it the answer about empowering more individual women to become business leaders or to be elected to power or to feel sexy with or without a new breast augmentation that they may have got 20% off in an International Women's Day special. It's not, as the t-shirt goes, stay calm and be Beyonce. I have to say, I do very much enjoy the music of Beyonce, but I do also have problems with the ideal of motherhood, which she represents, and the ideal of capitalist girl boss feminism. So what we need, therefore, is more than International Women's Day. We need more than awareness raising. We need more than talking about it. We need a revolution. Just as International Women's Day was fought for by the working class, International Women's Day should inspire liberation for all women, for mothers, for non-mothers, Palestinian women, trans women, working class women around the globe. For men too. And for anybody who doesn't feel like they fit into either of those gender categories, for all people, for all of humanity, a revolution along socialist principles would liberate us from the shackles that are this ideal. That's the legacy that the victims of that fire in New York in 1911, what they deserve. It's what the women who originally set up International Women's Day deserve. It's what the women of Palestine deserve. It's what we all deserve. I'm going to finish with a quote that I found on Instagram, which I just thought summed it up really well. It said, "Why do we tell mothers that the solution to their burnout is self-care? Because this requires nothing of society."
Future Heist is recorded and produced by me, Rena Neve-Smith, with original music by Benjamin Tassi, artwork by Fleur Beck. Follow us at future_heist on Instagram or Future Heist Podcast on Facebook and YouTube. You can find a transcript for this episode on renathejournalist.com/podcast. Special thanks to Chloe Vasegi. And if you liked this episode, please subscribe and tell a friend. Thank you.